Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, everybody. It's another Tuesday where genealogy and spirit connect, and sorry we're a little late. Life is full of surprises, including technology, and yeah, it was one of the things that I was going to lead in today, and we're going to go probably a little over because we're starting a little late. But, you know, whether you're on a spiritual journey or you're on a genealogy journey, you know, the ideas and the concepts of what you find as you progress through your learning experience is full of surprises. It's no different than a life's journey, really. And studying other people's life's journey is very similar to understanding what your life journey is all about. And, you know, as I've mentioned in previous shows, you know, I've been doing some caseloads, and it's pretty amazing, and I thought I'd share a couple of them with you today because they happened last week, and I, for a couple of reasons, I don't know why I seem to be attracting a lot of murder mysteries, but those are definitely very interesting as the healing and learning experience that people come up with after they accept and understand what was going on during the lives of these people. But, you know, it was interesting because during the week last week, I had a case where I was learning a little bit about this one client, and her ancestor was on one of the that Eastland tour boat in 1915 that capsized in Chicago. And I was doing some research on the actual event, and I started looking at it, and I said, boy, I have read this. I have been here. This is deja vu. And the more and more I read, I realized that one of the reasons I was aware of this particular situation was because I had researched it for my own genealogy, as one of my distant cousins was the general manager of the boat at that particular time. So you never know what's going to connect and what's not going to connect. And the third case I wanted to kind of share with you was someone who came to me, and she wanted to find out if she had any Jewish lines. And I wanted to mention it because it kind of leads into our guest today. But, you know, doing the generational work that I did with her line, it was pretty evident that if she had Jewish lines, it was not something that a researcher could really find out within the generations that we probably have access to. So it leads me into really what we're going to talk about today, because life is full of surprises, and no matter what you're researching and what you think about your family, you may find surprises all along the way. So I'm really, really excited to have our guest today, Shelly Dardashti, and I missed it, Shelly Telalai Dardashti. I was going to get it right. We went through this for a little bit yesterday because I knew I was going to not do it right, but I talked myself into not doing it right. Comes from us as a native New Yorker, and she currently lives in Tel Aviv, so now that might explain some of the lateness and tardiness of us getting started. But most of us know Shelly is probably one of the premier bloggers in the world, and specifically on Jewish genealogy. Her blog is called Tracing the Tribe, and she also blogs for MyHeritage, and who else do we know lately? But one of her primary interests, I think, is in the study of DNA genetic testing and in some of the things that she's finding out as she is co-administrator of the Iberian Ashkenazi DNA Project at Family Tree DNA. She's co-founder of GenClass.com. She's been a former Jerusalem Post Jewish genealogy columnist. She and I go back many, many, many years. So I welcome you, Shelly, to the show.
Thank you, Susan. It's great to be here.
So, we got some bubbles to pop, some surprises to make. And I do, before we really get started, we will be taking calls. So, the phone number, and I'm going to slow down just a little bit because I think I was talking way too fast. But the phone number is 888-815-9756. So, feel free to call anytime. We will be taking your calls. So, surprises. Let's talk about them.
Well, I think the I met Bennett Greenspan at one of the first Salt Lake City conferences, the National International Jewish Genealogy Conferences. I think it was right before Family Tree DNA went live.
Right.
And it was, from the way Bennett explained it that first day, we had all gone out to dinner. There was a group of us that had gone out to dinner, and every single one of us kept saying, wow, 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 wow. And I think all of us recognized at that point that this was going to be something very interesting. And it has proven to be that, no doubt. My particular connection with it has been in several ways. Number one, I have a Talalay group, an a DNA project group at Family Tree DNA. I also have a Dardashti group. The problem is getting people tested. But the two very exciting projects that I've been involved with, the first one I did a story on, which is Herb Hoepchner in New York. And Herb put together a group of ostensible Ashkenazim from Belarus, from Poland, from Lithuania, from Russia. And everybody's testing out, and everybody's genetically matching all of these Litvaks and Galicianers, which we all know usually stay on different sides of the room.
Right.
But what became most exciting about it was that they genetically matched a family that had been in Puerto Rico from the 1600s.
Wow.
Yeah. Talk about an identity crisis. First you realize that you genetically match, if you're a Litvak, you genetically match a Galicianer, which will right away is an identity crisis. And then to find out that, hey, maybe we're Sephardic. There are a lot of people still walking around in that project that are shaking their heads. They still haven't quite gotten their head around it yet. One of the people that I had interviewed for one of the several stories I wrote about this project, because Herb keeps putting more and more people into it, more and more people join. And this was Joe Farkas from Romania. I think his background is Romanian. And I had asked Joe, I said, why did you want to get involved in this? And he said, well, we've always had this story that we were Sephardic, and we knew that we went from Spain to Amsterdam, and we changed the name from Lopez to Wolf, cause that's a direct translation. And
right.
When we wound up in Romania, we changed it to Farkas, which is, again, another direct translation. And I said, but why? He said, well, they've always told us, we're Sephardim. I wanted to know if I can eat rice on Passover. So we decided that yes, we were going to act in the we were going to act as rabbis and tell him he could do that. But there are a lot of different reasons that people want to go the DNA route. Some of the projects that Family Tree DNA has attracted have been some really excellent ones, and I think the main reason, which is what we always write about Family Tree when we do talk about it, is that 9 out of 10 Jewish genealogists use Family Tree DNA. And the answer is very simple. Number one, it has the largest comparative database for all samples from all ethnicities and nationalities and countries, whatever.
Right.
But within that largest comparative database is the largest Jewish comparative database. Other companies may have only a few. They may have really none, but if you're a Jewish genealogist and you want to do DNA genetic genealogy, Family Tree DNA is the place to do it, because as Bennett always says, he says, in this respect, size matters. You need to have the correct number of people to test against. If there are no samples that are Jewish, who are you testing against?
Correct.
So you must have the larger sample. And what's very interesting is that, which leads me into my other interest, of course, which is in Sephardic genealogy and conversos and B'nai Anosim and this kind of thing, is that many of the Southwest, how do we explain it? There are a lot of projects geographically based. There's one on New Mexico, there's Southwest, there's Sicily, There's all kinds of ethnicities and states and groupings, and these are ostensibly, perhaps most likely, not Jews today, but who obviously do have Jewish roots when you look at their DNA and their haplogroups. But what's very exciting in what we're doing with the Iberian Ashkenaz group is that we're taking people who are definitely ostensible Ashkenazim, like we always thought our Talalais were, except for the one sentence that was handed down in every generation. This was our name when we left Spain. And everybody laughed about it. Nobody believed it. Oh, this is ridiculous. Well, you're just speaking Jews from, you know, from Belarus. What kind of nonsense is this? No one believes it. But out of the participants in the Iberian Ashkenaz group, and basically our criteria for acceptance in that group, we were only doing Y DNA, the male DNA, and out of the basic criteria was if a participant had a Sephardic name, as listed in many different resource books, was there an inherited Mediterranean genetic condition? Was there an oral history of way back when? Yes, we were Sephardic. This was the criteria we basically had for the Ashkenazic participants in this. And so far, we presented this actually in Philadelphia at the conference in August. And out of all the participants we've had so far, we have matched 75% of the ostensible Ashkenazim with people who are Hispanic, who absolutely know that they are conversos, that they're descendants of Jews, those that might have suspected it, and others that don't even know it. In fact, the funniest thing was, because it's one of the things we brought up at the Philadelphia conference when Judy Simon and I, she's the science end of the administration of this project, okay. And Judy told them that the Ashkenazim that were participating had this thing in the back of their mind. Yes, we have an Ashkenazi name. Yes, there's some kind of an oral history. Yes, there's an inherited Mediterranean condition. But what was exciting was that when the Hispanics who they matched were contacted, they were really confused, because if they knew that they had Jewish roots, they didn't understand why they were genetically matched to people from Eastern Europe. They expected to be matched to other Sephardim. And that in itself was another interesting piece of the project that we had to handle, and we had to explain to them that those people really weren't Ashkenazim. They really had Sephardic roots, and they wound up in Eastern Europe. So I think when I do presentations on this, I always say, so you think you're Ashkenazi? And it was very, very interesting, because there are a lot of people who have stories like this, who have an oral history,
yes,
and they just think it's ridiculous. They can't get their head around the fact that with Yiddish-speaking Ashkenazim, how can we be Sephardic? Even if they've heard an oral history, even if it's been told on and on and on again in every generation, it's difficult to accept it. So this is a thing that's very, very interesting, and it was obviously the same thing that turned out in Herb's project,
right?
Called the Worth Project, that all of these Eastern European Ashkenazim, Litvaks and Galicianas, match
the
Sephardim. So there's a lot that we can get out of this. And we're talking about also the projects like the New Mexico Project,
right,
which has a very, very large number of participants. And there are a lot of people in there that fall into what are recognized as common Jewish haplogroups, like J1 and J2. Many of them that have been tested have the Cohen modal signature.
Right.
So it's... You're not always who you think you are, and there's usually a lot more to it.
You know, that's very true, and yeah, you know, I wanted to interject a little bit, because we talked about this yesterday. You know, I think it was back in 1998 I got very interested in the whole crypto-Judaic concept because I happen to have a Sephardic family. And I was really just interested in the fact that, you know, perhaps here I was, a Jewish, you know, Sephardic, you know, line, that, you know, there's a possibility that, the people, I'm in Texas, of course, and that, you know, some of the people that I, you know, that are out there, that are around me all the time, that, you know, it's very possible that, we could be related. You know, going back to Spain and the Inquisition, and I was really, really fascinated with it, and I spent about a year, and I traveled to New Mexico many times to visit with Dr. Hortus, and met with, you know, went to some of the first early conferences, and, you know, it was fascinating. The cemeteries were fascinating. I mean, it was very, very what's the word I want to use? There was no question.
Intriguing. Intriguing.
There was no question that some of these Lopez's and these, you know, individuals had Jewish heritage. There were signs on these tombstones that were really indicative. There was the upside down shin. There were, you know, the Kohanim. It was just amazing. And we went cemetery to cemetery throughout New Mexico, and, you know, and the discussions and the stories that, these people would talk about was how they practiced some of the, you know, Judaism in secret, and they lit candles, but they did it in the bathroom where there were no windows, and they, you know, they, you know, went to butchers who would slaughter the animals in the way that the Jews had their animals slaughtered. It just fascinated me. The whole thing fascinated me, and I've been fascinated with it ever since. And I think you're right, Shelley, because, you know, this whole concept that we have now of DNA testing, and, you know, my involvement with Bennett also went back to, you know, 2000, I think, when, you know, we launched the DNA testing on Jewish Gen. Mm-hmm. To a world of not so happy people at that particular time, but I think that over the years, everybody has pretty much, you know, embraced the concept. But it was new at the time, and I understand that. But
I mean, yeah, I'm sorry. Go
but
ahead.
It doesn't matter what religion you are, really. You know, the whole concept of DNA testing, you know, to understand your heritage and understand where you came from is really one of the finest tools out there. As I mentioned in my intro, you know, there are just a certain amount of things we can do from, you know, genealogically going back so many generations, that, you know, only DNA testing can really put the, you know, really take us from point A to point B.
Absolutely. I think one of the things I just learned about this week is that we have this very strong oral history in the family. And I
right.
have several people who have tested. And the haplogroup that we're in is, until very recently, wasn't really considered commonly found in Sephardic regions. It was generally a Northern Europe kind of thing. And just this week, Judy Simon found out from another researcher that he has found this particular haplogroup basically in the Mediterranean and in Spain and in Italy. According to him, he believes this is a Sephardic group, and which of course coincides with our family history, so I'm very happy about that. But even further, and you're right, it has nothing to do really with religion. It has to do with knowing your roots and knowing who you really are and how you can find more information about your ancestors. I think in the case of us as Jewish researchers, because of the history that we've gone through from 1492, from the 1270s, from 1391, right across Europe, every country, and because of all the things that we've been through, our history is so chopped up and there are black holes all over the place. And it's hard to fill in the gaps. Now, but the best thing about the DNA work is that you can now fill in those gaps. You can cross over and you can find people that match you genetically. And then between those people, you can perhaps sit down and collaborate and begin to research and share. I think one of the most exciting things that happened to me was that in Spain, because we were going along on this whole thing, and this happened quite a number of years ago, and I said, there has to be something. It's such a rare name. It's a rare name Jewishly. Talalay is a very rare name. If I find it anywhere, they are 99.9% guaranteed to be related. And I said, look, if it's this rare in the Jewish world, in the Ashkenazi Jewish world, let's see what shows up in the Sephardic world. And I have a very good friend who's a researcher in Barcelona, Maria José Surivas. And on one of my trips to Barcelona, we went to the archives in Lerida, which is in Catalonia. It's about 140 kilometers northwest of Barcelona. And we actually found one document dated 1353 for a Talalaya, Talalay with an A at the end, who was a kosher winemaker for this in this outside the city of Lerida, and the document was a legal contract drawn up, signed by the heads of the city of Lerida and the Jewish community, the Alhama, the community organization, and our hopefully, probably we keep hoping, our ancestor. and when it was translated, because Maria José is a former attorney who is now a genealogist and a researcher, when it was translated into colloquial English, it was exactly like a contract that would be written today. And just sitting and reading this and then keep looking at the date and saying, but this is 1353. And realizing that I have a document from what we believe is our family from 1353. We've also found other documents over the years dated 1394, which is significant because we don't find much else after 1394. 1391 was when they had mass riots in every city in Spain, and there were mass conversions, forcible conversions. There were lots of murders. It was a terrible time, and a lot of people just decided to pick up and leave at that point. Going from, if you look at the map, you see Catalonia, which is northeastern Spain, and you can walk right into France, which at that time was also known as French Catalonia because they also spoke Catalan. And once you're in France, you can go to Germany, you can go to Poland, you can go anywhere you want because the whole country, all those countries are there. And obviously because of other historical events, if they may have decided to settle somewhere and then had to move on for various reasons. But that's how we wound up in Belarus. And there are other people that wound up in other cities. I remember at the New York conference in 2006, Rose Larracone from the Israel Genealogical Society. Rose did a program on Sephardim in Lithuania. And she gave us lists of Sephardic synagogues, of people with Sephardic names, and it was a very, very detailed program. And that also opened a lot of people's eyes. Because when I started talking about this, that our family was Sephardic and came from Mogilev, and when I started researching and found there were at least a dozen or so more also Sephardic families in Mogilev, which is a strange place because people left from Mogilev. They didn't go there, which meant they came quite a long time ago. And when I started talking about it on Jewish Gen, I got yelled at by everybody. How would Sephardi go into Eastern Europe? It was like Davy Crockett going to the frontier of Kentucky. And I had to remind them that many of the traders and merchants in Kentucky at the time, Davy Crockett, were also Jewish. I had gotten a lot of emails at that point from people who said, yes, we're from Mogilev, and we know that we're Sephardic, and the great-grandfather was a rabbi here and then went to Mogilev. And there were people that were communicating and that were sharing and collaborating even then. And it, at some point, we were almost afraid to talk about it because whenever we mentioned something on Jewish Gen, some very well-known people would, like, start yelling at us that this is an impossibility. But being genealogists, we don't believe in impossibilities. So.
You can't. I mean, you know, I don't know. I probably failed to mention. And one of the most interesting DNA stories that I have just happened really very recently. In fact, I was just talking to Bennett before we went on air because I have an adopted brother, and I have finally gotten him, talked him into doing his DNA testing. So we're getting ready to get his done. But in addition to that, and you know, this is a I have a very interesting history. My mother was adopted, and I had my brother tested, my natural brother tested for both the Y and mtDNA back in 2000. And just recently, I got a email from a cousin of mine on my male side of the family, and we've been in touch on the Krulevich side of the family for probably even before Jewish Gen in the early BBS days. And he writes to me, he says, you know, I just got my DNA test. He says, imagine my surprise when I connected with your brother on the maternal side. So we haven't figured that one out, but apparently there's a connection not only on my paternal side, but on my maternal side of that we don't even know where it, what it is. So you don't know, and there, it's full of surprises. And I mean, I remember I almost fell out of my chair because he was shocked. I was shocked.
Well,
how can this be?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the mtDNA because even as far as most recently as last year, mtDNA was considered, it's great for anthropological genealogy, like we all came out of Africa 50, 60, 70,000 years ago. And it was not as focused. You couldn't get that much genealogical information out of it just because it doesn't change as much as the Y-DNA.
Right.
So in my understanding, my layman's understanding of this, is that because it doesn't change, it's great for going back several tens of thousands of years, but it's really not so great at, you know, maybe 100, 200, 300 years ago. But what they've done now, they've been able to focus more the mtDNA, which is a much more detailed maternal DNA testing. And this really can supply a lot of, let's put it, contemporary genealogical information as to where the people lived, where they were actually from. So that's changed. And I think when Bennett spoke at the Southern California Genealogical Society Jamboree last year in June, and he was talking about this, and he said, this is the next newest, most amazing thing that will be available, because now we can focus in on the maternal side.
Right.
To bring it into contemporary terms. So there's always something coming down the road with this, and there are always surprises. It's fantastic for people who have adoption situations. And it's we don't have a lot of records. Some people may have a lot of records, depending on where the origin is.
Right.
But a lot of people don't have a lot of records. And jumps the gap, and it provides information, and it prevents some wild goose chases.
Right.
But it also tends to provide more questions than sometimes
than answers.
Yes, because you find something that's way more interesting, and you have to figure out why that happened. But it's a wonderful tool. It's great, and it's I just love hearing the stories of people that have used it and found fascinating information. I have a friend here in Israel who's originally from England, and by chance she connected with a relative of, they supposed, her husband's family way back in Poland. And they recently just did a test, and the grandfather, the father of this woman, or grandfather, was like 95, I don't know how old he is. Anyway, it came back as a perfect genetic match for her husband.
Wow.
And now they're trying to figure out actually how, what is the relationship between the two of them. They think they know it's a brother of a great-grandfather. But the fact that there's a perfect genetic match gives them an impetus to really go after the records now. And because one of the family members lives in Poland, it's a lot easier because she can access the records.
Well, you know, I notice that people get frustrated because, you know, the records don't exist. And in fact, this client that I had who was trying, you know, wanted me to trace, you know, get her back to some Jewish lines, which I could not do 5-6 generations with the records that we have. You know, I did suggest some DNA testing because really at some point, I mean, if she really wanted to know, that was actually the first thing I would suggest. And you know, one of the things that I think I hear from people, and maybe you can answer it too, is, you know, people get a little worried about the privacy of the DNA testing and, you know, that kind of thing. But it's, you know, it's pretty secure, and it can be as secure as you want it to be.
Absolutely.
You know, so you know, I think that that's really one of the biggest, only one of the biggest fears that I hear from people about doing DNA testing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we still hear at conferences.
The sampling's different than what you would test for, you know, murders and those kinds of things.
Exactly. That's what I was going to bring up. At every conference that Family Tree DNA is at, someone comes up with it and says, well, you know, you're going to know if I'm the father of this kid or, you know, I've committed a crime. And I, and the answer is always, well, we can, the closest we can get is that perhaps someone that committed a crime is someone in your entire family line going back hundreds of thousands of years. You know, we can't tell you exactly who that person is. You know, I mean, they're not going to come after you, you know.
Right.
And that, I think, is people worry about that because they think there's this, you know, this huge DNA database and they're going to be going into that. And that's not true because at least at Family Tree DNA, everything is kept very, very private and under very strict conditions.
Right. And the testing is such that the I don't think they could really get the information that they would be.
No. It's, I mean, it uses a, well, what's termed the junk DNA. And not this, not the kinds of DNA that are used for paternity testing or forensics, that kind of a thing. So it doesn't use that. But,
right.
I don't think people should be worried about that. But what it can connect, and what's most amazing is, again, if you don't have the records, and if you're looking for possible Jewish ancestry, the important thing is to see who you match today. Who are those families that you match today? What is their history?
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a question because, you know, so I have my brother tested, and we know that we have some Sephardic lineage.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way for us to get into your project and have our, how does this work?
1 second.
Sure.
The mute button is very useful when someone's just getting over bronchitis.
There you go.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. But I'm just wondering, because basically our criteria is for Ashkenazim, that think they have Iberian, for lack of a better word, Sephardic ancestry. There are other groups. There are many groups that actually look at Sephardic sampling. There's the New Mexico group. There's the Sicily group. There's there are a number of groups.
Well, we
depending
have two
on the,
sides.
Right.
We got both Sephardic and Ashkenazi on my father's lineage.
Right. Judy Simon is the gatekeeper.
Okay.
For lack of a better word. And I'm not sure if she's listening. I told her about it.
Okay.
But if people want to contact me about that, I will be more than happy to pass that on and have them speak with Judy because she's the arbiter of that.
I got you.
And actually, I think what we're adding now, we're also going to be adding an mtDNA section to our Iberian Ashkenaz project. Previously, it was only YDNA, mm-hmm. and I believe that this year now we're going to start adding the mtDNA.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, going back to my brother who has not been tested,
mm-hmm.
we know yes. that his father was Jewish. Mm-hmm. So this is what we know. And the mother was Irish Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be very interesting, you know, to see where he ends up here in both sides of his, you know, DNA testing. But
well,
we don't know. We don't know where he, I mean, yeah, we have
you
no
absolutely clue. Don't know. And, you know, when we talk about Jewish migration patterns, Jews went everywhere in the world. There are some people who believe that everybody in Ireland was originally Jewish, you know. there are a lot of different theories, and people went everywhere, and Jews went as traders and merchants and slaves. They were taken by the Romans all over the known world. There's always a possibility. There's always that possibility that something is going to show up, and we just don't know. Every time someone asks me this kind of question, the first thing I do is advise them to get tested. I said, number one, if you have a match, as I said before, it'll show you to whom you match today, and you'll understand their ancestry and their religion and understand perhaps they have the information that you're looking for. Someone else has your information, but you won't know to contact them unless you know that you're related to them. And I said, and even if you're not related to anybody right now, someone might be tested 6 months from now, and they may be your genetic match, and they may have the information you need. So I always tend to tell people, get tested. Number one, you'll grow the database, and there'll be more likelihood of matches.
Right.
And you may also be very surprised. You might make the right connection with the right group of people. And it's just very exciting. You sit on the edge of your seat until you get the results, so... and see who you're
it
related
is.
To.
Now, you know, for the audience who's not really, you know, may not all be, you know, fully knowledgeable about the whole DNA testing,
mm-hmm.
It's usually, I guess, from what I understand, and I don't think I am the scientific side of DNA testing either, that the best testing is done by the male. Is that correct?
I believe until this year, yes. But now with this extra mtDNA and the enhanced testing, it may not be as significant. I think let's put it this way. It was considered, I think the YDNA was considered better because the family names came down through the male side and because there were more mutations. It was easier to sort people into different lineages and different branches.
Right.
And the mtDNA was good for anthropological DNA. And if Bennett's listening and I'm wrong, he'll send me a nasty email, I'm sure. But the men inherit the Y chromosome from their father, from their father, from their father, from their father, all the way back.
Right.
The mtDNA is passed down to the daughter from the mother, from the mother, from the mother, but the sons also have the mtDNA. So when you test a male, you get his father's line and his mother's line.
Right.
So that's extremely important. And I know that one thing that, especially at Family Tree DNA, they're really trying to build up the mtDNA databases because it's as technology increases and there's so much more that can be done with this information, the more samples that are in the database, the better it is for everybody, and the more information that an individual can find. I've had a lot of cases where people say, oh, but there's no matches, we don't match anybody, we must have come from the moon. And I said, no, your matches just haven't tested yet. So you have to be patient. But
right.
It's something that the technology is growing all the time. And if we're going back to why DNA was more important, that is true that in many cases the males carry the family name going down. But when we look at Jewish history, until the 1800s, in some places until the 1800s, family names were not required. So you're not talking about maybe in England, where they've had family names for quite a long time. In Spain, they've had family names. You can go to the archives, and there are documents in there from the year 1000 that have first names and family names. And so the Sephardic names are very important because they really go back a long time. And because of the Sephardic naming patterns, using a mother's maiden name with the father's name, you can really go back quite a ways on those various lineages. And the archives are fantastic. So, you know, when you're talking Sephardic genealogy, there are names that go back until the year 1000. There are names that are still used today in variations, because in Spain they went from various Spanish dialects, and there was also an overlay. You had Latin, and you had Spanish, and you had Old French, and you had all kinds of things. You had Arabic as well. So as Jeff Malka, who's an amazing Sephardic researcher, he's kind of like the pioneer of Sephardic genealogy in America, and his two books are wonderful, the first edition and the second one that's just been expanded. And Jeff talks about and demonstrates the evolution of his name, Malka, going back through the centuries, and how it was written in Arabic, and how it was written in Hebrew, and how it changed into Castilian, and how it looked in Catalan. And he traces it all the way through, and you can see it's the same name, but there are different suffixes and different prefixes, and the spelling is different, but it's the same name, and it's recognizable, which makes Sephardic genealogy very interesting, because we have names and we have documents in many countries.
And, you know, I know that Family Tree DNA is doing a lot of Native American testing, too.
Absolutely.
And, you know, one of the things that I'm seeing more and more and more is, you know, there's probably more Native American blood in this country than anything out there, because of the early pioneers and the early settlers. It's, I've never seen so much as I, you know, get back out into the whole genealogy world, you know, how many people really think that they have Native American blood or want to have Native American blood.
Oh, yes, and we've all heard that story about my ancestor was an Indian princess, yes. And I think that's the one of the wonderful things about family tree DNA specifically is that we're talking now obviously about Jewish DNA or Jewish families or this kind of this heritage, but their database encompasses so many ethnicities and so many nationalities, and that's why it's one of the biggest, you know, it is the biggest comparative database, because they encompass everybody and everything, and it makes it extremely important for people that are interested in genetic genealogy.
And
absolutely,
I do have a distant relative somewhere out in Utah that did marry an Indian princess, so there you have the Jewish.
And of course the conversos that came across, they came from Spain after the Inquisition, some of them not until the 1600s, and they came into Mexico and then came up into New Mexico and the other southwestern territories, and many of them believed and kept to the tradition of marrying into other converso families that were also somehow related, but many of them also married Native American people. So there's definitely an admixture. Definitely there's an admixture. And that's part of history. And we need to be aware of that, and we need to say that's history and that's part of our heritage and that's part of what happened. And it really makes you think differently about history when you have this. When you get back a set of results and you see the matches, if you're fortunate enough to have a lot of matches, and you see the origins of the people to whom one person actually matches, and they're all over the place. You'll have somebody from England matching somebody from Russia, and somebody from the Southwest matching somebody else, and you just sit there and you go, this is history. This is history in front of our eyes. This is immigration. This is people who went all around the world. And you never really, again, you don't know what you're going to find. So
a big surprise. But it also goes back, too, to the whole spiritual nature, I think, of learning about yourself and really going back to the fact that we're all, you know, human beings, and we all connect somewhere, somehow, in the most least likely place, and, you know, taking us back with those 64,000 plus generations, you know, I think that that's really the exciting part of the research, I think, that's going to come out of the DNA is, you know, that, at the beginning of time, we really do all, at some point, source to the same place.
Absolutely. And, I mean, that's what history is.
Yes.
And I think one of the things that's so important about this is, as genealogists, we look at history in one way. And I think we can say that all genealogists are historians because it's part and parcel of what we do.
Exactly.
But not all historians are genealogists.
Now, that's the truth.
Yeah. So this is another way of looking at history and looking at genealogy. And the more, and it is true, the more we know about where we come from and who our ancestors are, the more we know who we are and what we're doing with our lives. I'm very fond of telling people that until I discovered genealogy, I hated history. I was just, I couldn't stand dates. Who cares about these dates? Who cares about these places? Who cares who did what? And that was before I realized that once I started doing family history research, was that all of these places, I had a relative that lived there at that time. And all of a sudden, instead of becoming dusty places and dry old dates and things like that, it becomes part of who you are. And you look at it in a totally different way. If something had happened to one of your direct ancestors, if they were killed in a war or they were in a shipwreck or something happened before they married and had children, and then you sit there and you go, well, if that had happened to one of those people, I wouldn't be here. And it's a very interesting kind of way of actually connecting with history. It becomes very personal. Because if something had happened that shouldn't have happened, you wouldn't be there thinking about those things.
Right. And at the end of the day, too, I mean, you know, we're all connected to life, and we're all connected to history in one shape, form, or another. And, you know, it is such an interesting journey that we're on. And, you know, being the genealogy journey that really sparked a spiritual journey for me, it's probably one of the most exciting things that anyone can do for either themselves or for someone else. The sparks of light that come from people when they learn just a little bit that they didn't know about their family and their family history. And, it is an amazing experience. And not only when you do it from the perspective of doing your own research, but you know, now working with people and helping them do their own. And you know that from teaching your classes, which you might want to talk about too, that there is nothing more beautiful, you know, for me than, you know, to see and feel the excitement and, you know, the questions and, oh my goodness, is that, you know, I can't believe this. I had no idea. And, you know, it's those surprises in life that you find and about yourself and learning a little bit about, you know, who they were and where they lived and how they lived. And, you know, you talk about history. Geography was my weakness. You know, I mean, you know, that's, I'm still having to look at maps to figure out where things are in relation to each other. So none of those subjects were of big interest to me when I was in school.
Until.
Until. I think I was 30-something when I started in this journey, and I hate to say how many years ago it is. So, but you want to talk a little bit about
sure.
your Gen class? I think that's important.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It was very interesting because when Micha Reisel and I, we were both teaching, going back a few years when MyFamily.com, which is part of Ancestry, was offering genealogy classes in a wide range of diverse topics. It was always considered the best hidden secret at Ancestry. And one day they woke up and decided they weren't going to do these classes anymore. And Micha and I said, well, this is really not a good idea. We need to do something about this. So we co-founded GenClass.com, and we gathered a lot of teachers that had been teaching at MyFamily.com, and we decided to offer similar online classes in, again, a wide range of topics. It's not just Jewish genealogy. It's there are two sessions on going to Salt Lake City to the Family History Library. There's finding people in large communities. There's looking for Polish ancestry, for Scottish ancestry. If you go to genclass.com, you can see the entire list of courses. They're short-term,
mm-hmm.
very practical jumpstart classes. This is how you get started. You get the tools, the practical tools of learning what resources you need for that particular class, for that particular research, how to find those resources, how to access them, what to do once you find them. Again, short-term practical courses that you can do basically on your own at home with conversations with the classes and with the teachers, depending on how each teacher is setting up their own particular class. And it's very interesting because it's the idea of giving people the tools to do it themselves. I mean, I think we always have the saying in genealogy, nobody cares more about your genealogy than you do. And asking someone to do it professionally is one way of doing it. That's very nice. But I know from my own research that if I'm looking at a resource and something just hits my brain, and I remember back to something I heard when I was 5 or 6 years old. There's a name, there's a place, something is triggering my memory. And I go, another researcher wouldn't have known that because they didn't have those experiences that I had of sitting and talking to a great-grandmother or a grandfather. And if you can do your own research, and if you're lucky enough to have these buried memories of places and names, you can find the clues to go back even further and to develop your own research. But I'm always a firm believer in give people the tools so that they know how to do it themselves. And that's, of course, not a slam at professional researchers, because honestly, there's stuff that I don't know that I would like to have a professional researcher to help me on some of my stuff. But I think one of the most important things also about this to bring in, Susan, is that when we both started, everybody was a generalist. Genealogists were supposed to know everything about everything.
Right.
And once things developed, we all became specialists. And you had to become a specialist because there's not one person out there that can remember all of the generalist stuff. And we tended to become experts on particular topics because those were our own favorite topics about or concerned. We developed those skills doing our own research from our own families.
Right.
But the whole idea is that there's no one that's really a generalist anymore, and I pride myself in that if somebody asks me a question, I can say, I don't know, but I know someone who does, and put them in contact. I have people that are asking all the time about specific things about census records and things in England. I know nothing about that, and I have no compunction about saying that, but I know who does.
Right.
And I send those people to the experts. And when you send somebody to who's asking about a census record in the UK, and you send them to somebody like Celia Mayle, who's amazing in UK, in London, and she finds the information in 15 minutes, and I don't know how she does it, but she does it, she knows it, and that's the kind of person you want to send somebody to, because there's no learning curve. It's something they've done a million times. They know exactly where to go. They know exactly where to find that information, and you have it, and you don't have to spend hours on it. And it's wonderful to direct people to the experts who can help them. So, I mean, I get questions. I got, I don't know how many questions I got today on the blog about somebody who's, can't remember. There was, the guy was talking about his mother who had been orphaned by the time she was 12, and he only knew the family name of the grandfather, and how could they find information? And so where are the records? Well, obviously the first thing I did was tell him to get tested at Family Tree DNA to see who they're related to. And then I said, well, there's census records, and there are these records, and there are those records. So he said, oh, well, how can I access them? Where do you live? Okay, go to your public library and start working with, you know, with census records and online subscription sites that the library offers for free. There are a lot of records out there. But I said, because you're talking about a family that was divided so long ago, this is like one of these perfect candidates for genetic genealogy, because you'll see who you're related to today. And then you can narrow down your connections.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that I try to do with, you know, my clients is to just help them get jump started. Yeah, mm-hmm. I am a firm believer in doing as much research of your own as you can. But a lot of times they either get stuck or there's a particular situation that they need to get beyond where they need, you know, before they can move on.
Absolutely. I mean,
and that's really the steps. I am not interested, and I'll tell this to the world. I'm not interested in doing somebody's genealogy from here to eternity. I don't want to do that. But what I enjoy helping people when they get to a point where they've done a certain amount and they don't know where to go. And I basically serve as a consultant, and I get them past those brick walls. And
absolutely,
that's what I enjoy the most. And in fact, I just got an email.
You're a problem solver. You're a problem solver.
Exactly. I'm a consultant. I see myself more as a consultant than a genealogy researcher.
Right. And this is a perfect lead-in also to the term that we use, genealogy blogging. Because what we are doing as genealogy bloggers, and there's a group of about 40 or 50 or 60 of the most active ones, but literally there are more than 1,000 genealogy blogs right now, and more of them are started every day. Now, what I tend to do at Tracing the Tribe is to inform people about new resources, new online resources, new country resources, things that are new that are coming along. There are some of us as genealogy bloggers that read 400 or 500 blogs a day. I don't know how they do it. I can skim through a lot.
Right.
and I have over 110 Google alerts set up, so I've got to do that every day. But to be able to find a new resource that no one knows about yet and to get it up there.
Right.
And for people to say, thank you, I went to that source and I found the name I was looking for. And I went, wow, it was worth it. Just because I didn't get any sleep for 3 days.
I don't know how y'all do it. I mean, I'm not a blogger. I do write a column, and I'm way behind because I've been doing so many other different things. But I've got my storylines all set up. I just haven't sat down and written them. But
I do write a column.
You know, that ties into my topic here on the radio show where genealogy and spirit connect.
Right.
And, you know, I'm having, I don't know how y'all do it. It's not me. I will tell you
I remember when I first started and, I was into the third or fourth day, I think, of writing it. And one of the, major bloggers wrote to me. I think it was Drew Smith at the time, or George Morgan. Drew Smith and George Morgan are the genealogy guys. They do the podcasts.
Okay.
And George Morgan wrote to me and said, you have to be really careful and don't let it take over your life. And I, this is like day three or four, and I said, George, you're already too late.
Well, you know, we need to warn everybody that if they do get into genealogy, it will take over their lives. You know,
yes,
it's one of the worst bugs you can catch, in my opinion.
It's definitely an addiction. obsessive.
It's hard to break. It's definitely one of those. I guess somebody could make a living doing the 10 steps to breaking the genealogy addiction.
Well, I would want to.
I know.
The minute we left that, we would go right back to it.
Well, some of the spouses might.
Yes,
that have no interest. Some of the spouses and family members that don't have any interest might really want to go through a 10-step program on how to break my spouse or loved one from the genealogy.
I mean, but the funny thing is when you have a spouse that isn't into it. I mean, my husband is so not into genealogy, but I do the Dardashti family. I'm the keeper of the records, so everybody's always asking me for information, and well, he's really not interested in it. But when someone asks him a question, he'll say, oh, I don't know, but ask Shelley. She knows all the answers to the family. And even though they're not doing it themselves, again, they're really happy that someone's doing it. And that was also very hard. I mean, just going back for a minute, Sephardic genealogy, the records are there. The records are there from the year 1000. There are records in Istanbul. There are records in Spain. There are records in Portugal. There are Inquisition court records. There's a record of most passengers who left Spain for the New World. They're sitting in Seville. And there are records all over the place. When you get into things like Persian genealogy, there's nothing.
Right.
There are no records. Everything, it was like the Persian education system. It was you learn things by rote. And that was handy in my case because I was very fortunate in that I was able to interview for hours, multiples of hours, several of our, what I called walking encyclopedias in Los Angeles. And we've lost all of them now. But all the information that I was able to get out of the interview. Some people I interviewed for 8 hours, some for 10 hours. And they remembered everything as it had happened, things that happened 60, 70 years ago. Who married who, the names of the kids, where they lived. And I couldn't write fast enough. And we started recording them because there was no way to write that fast. And that was extremely useful. We went back to something like 1850 in one interview, I went back to 1850 in something like 2 hours.
Wow.
And then we were kind of stuck until one of our cousins in America had come back to Israel because his father had passed away, and they were going through the father's books, and they found an old siddur, an old Jewish prayer book, that the father had received from his older uncle. In the cover of the book, inside the cover, were three more generations.
Mm-hmm.
So we had went back again almost another 100 years, which is almost unheard of when you're doing Persian Jewish genealogy, because there really are no records unless the family preserved it. And with and over history, people moved from the provinces and moved to Tehran. And we know what it's like when we move; we lose things all the time.
And we throw them away too because we don't think they're very important.
Throw them away because we forget what's in there and we don't look. And there are, let's say, there are records still in Tehran at the Crown, at the Chief Rabbi's office, but they're not indexed in any usable format. You have to know the exact date of an event and the exact names of the people involved. If you knew the exact date and the names of the people involved, you wouldn't need those records. Talk about it, it's like catch-22, of course. But even in Persian Jewish genealogy, there's one guy that went back to Tehran and has a wonderful website. He went and photographed almost all the gravestones at the main Jewish cemetery called Beheshtiye in Tehran. And he has a website, beheshtiye.com, and there are photos of all the gravestones and the inscriptions. Some of them are translated, some of them aren't. Originally, the index was only by first name, which is for genealogists makes you a little crazy.
Right.
It took me 4 hours to go through to find two of the Dardashtis that I knew were in there, but I had to go through and I had to read every single stone, every photograph. But now it seems to be that they're actually, there's another index being worked on, and some of them are actually by family name, which I was very happy to see. So in every country that might be of interest, there are records of some kind. Whether you can access them or not is a different story. In Turkey, for example, many of the old records are written in Solotreo, which is the old kind of Rashi Hebrew script, and hardly anybody can read it today. The best thing about Turkey is that all the records are preserved. They're in archives. The problem is that only a handful of researchers can read them.
Right.
But at least they're preserved. So, you know, which is a good thing. I prefer to have them preserved and nobody be able to read them than to not have them preserved at all. But in every country it's like that. We found, when I started doing research in Belarus, we found for our little shtetl, 12 miles outside of Mogilev, 12 miles southwest of Mogilev, Wodotynchtina, we found the records, we found the book in the Minsk archives for the second set of registries for the synagogue on Vorotynchtina that it was shared by the adjacent village of Zavorezhye and the agricultural colony Vorotynchtina. And we found the second registry. So there were 750 names.
Wow.
And marriages and births and deaths. And so far we haven't found the first registry book. We'd like to get that one. But, you know, you take what you can get. So...
Well, and it is piecing the puzzle together, and there are so many ways to piece the puzzle together, and whether it's, you know, European records and some of the records, census records in the States, DNA mm-hmm. testing, cemetery records, family stories, family Bibles, and, you know, and I don't know about you, but I've come across a couple cases where I think I have aliens. Yeah.
We see that a lot. We see that a lot. In fact, in getting to the genealogy, there's a group called G2C, and these people have no clues to where they're from. They all swear that they're not from Earth. They're from heaven.
I know, the third rock from the sun. Here we go.
Exactly. But, and it's true, there are so many resources. I mean, one thing that I always tell people, and I repeat it a lot in the blog, never discount a family story. Write down every story that you hear. There's always some truth in every story. There's a kernel of truth in there that maybe has been embellished over the centuries, just to make it sound better. But there's a kernel of truth in there. If you don't record that story and you go pish-posh, that's, you know, it's nonsense, it's silly, it's just ridiculous. If you don't record that story somehow, when we finally do get time travel and transporters and time machines, and when you're in a position to actually go back and see, if you don't record that story, we won't know what to look for. So this is what I'm hoping for. I'm waiting for one of the IHAGS international conferences at which they unveil the first genealogy time machine. That's what I'm waiting for. And I'm waiting to see the lines out the door. I don't think it matters what they would charge for 5 or 10 minutes.
There you go.
But just the idea of going back to try and solve the problem, one piece of one problem that's right. been confusing you for 10 or 20 years.
Right.
And I guess the one thing that you have to watch out for in time travel is that if you go back, you don't actually appear right in front of one of your relatives that would probably, you know, shock them.
No, they come and appear before you and shock you is what they do.
Yeah. But talking about time travel, I have a Russian cousin who emigrated to the States. And he actually is working on the theoretical aspect of time travel. And I said, oh, my God, that's fantastic. How interesting is that? And he goes, why are you so excited about it? I said, are you kidding? Every genealogist wants their own little time machine. And he said, why? And I said, because we can go back and we can prove stories and we can see what happened. We'll know what happens. We can answer these questions. And I'm going on and on and on. He said, I never knew that. So I said, would you please hurry up and do this while I'm still able to travel?
Well, you know, I've actually had some guests on the show that can do what you're saying. I think that it is within reach. There are a lot of mediums and psychic, you know, mediums that can actually see and draw and tell stories that I've seen them in action. It is absolutely amazing. And I think that all of us have a little piece of that inside of us. And if we used it a little bit when we did our genealogies, I think we might be able to build our own little time machine.
I think that's possible. I know in my family, my grandmother and my great-grandmother absolutely had ESP qualities.
Yes.
And which were never really talked about because it wasn't considered exactly acceptable. And yet I've heard these stories through my family. And there were older relatives who swore that they spoke to relatives before them that had passed on. And we kind of sat there and went, yeah, sure. But as you get older and you see more of it and you go, okay, well, now I guess it's a little bit more acceptable than it was back then. Because back then, if anybody mentioned it, you would go, shh, you know, don't talk about this. Because it was considered very strange and very, very weird and definitely not acceptable conversation. And I think today, whether it's because of television and all these shows like The Mentalist, and a lot of other shows, sure. I think people are getting more used to seeing the possibilities, if we can use that phrase.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've seen it in action and you know, I use it a lot in my work.
Mm-hmm.
I've been starting to do that a lot. You know, I mean, I've been finding, you know, leads that, you know, very interesting. I had a case Sunday where I think I thought I knew where I was going, and I had someone lead me down the right path, but I was barking up the wrong tree. It was pretty amazing. I just was flabbergasted, but I put this case down because I just could not break it. And I picked it up Sunday, and I said, okay, I'm going to do this. And I did, and I picked up on one of the siblings of this particular individual. And I'm going to tell you, I never found him, but I found the whole family, and I took not only that family back two generations, but I've actually found descendants that they didn't know. You know, a few hours, 5 hours time.
You know, I think it's all chalked up to whatever works.
There you go.
Whatever you can use. And then, of course, whatever you can prove out of what you...
Right. Well, the proving...
You need proof also. But... anything that helps you solve a piece of the puzzle, anything that helps you to look at something in a different way and make a connection, all of it is extremely useful. And I guess the point is you just can't discount anything. You've got to write everything down. You've got to record everything. You've got to use every tool at your disposal, perhaps no matter how silly it seems or how kind of fringy it seems, because you never know. And that's always the point. We never know what we can find until we actually start looking.
Right. And then you don't
every tool. Yeah.
And then you don't know what you're going to find till you find it.
Absolutely. And then it just raises more questions than answers.
you got to love it. You got to love it. Shelly, it has been, I know it's getting towards the midnight hour, and you're past the midnight hour in your time.
No, it's only 10:23 here.
Only 10:23 there.
It's only 10:23 p.m. here. It's a little dark.
It has been actually a delightful hour. I thank you for being with me. It's good to talk to you again. It's been a couple of years, I think, since we've had a chance to talk. You know, it's really interesting. You know I'm a musician, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I know you know Jean Wilcox-Hibben. She's mm-hmm. one of your fellow bloggers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I connected with her because she's got her website. You know, my topic here is where genealogy and spirit connect. Hers is where music and ancestry meet.
Ooh.
Interesting. She's going to be
yes.
my guest next week. We're going to talk
wonderful.
All about music and our ancestry and all kinds of interesting things. And, you know, my instrument is was only developed here in Trinidad in the 1940s. So the instrument that I play doesn't go back multiple hundreds and thousands of years. But we're going to talk about, you know, how musical instruments were used in our families
okay,
throughout the years. I think it's going to be really fascinating.
Oh, I think so. I mean, and I know from my own family that there was no television. There was barely a radio. So every single one of my great-grandparents' kids played an instrument and sang.
Well, she
because
claims
you made your own music.
Right, and she claims they were used as chaperones for courting couples.
Yes.
We might be very educational for the new generations.
I think so. Yeah. What do they say? Everything new is really old again. So.
That's true.
It's from the past. Everything just keeps repeating.
It does. Thanks yep. again, and
Susan,
we will.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're quite welcome, and you can find Shelley at
yep.
tracingthetribe.blogspot.com. That's your primary
Absolutely.
Contact information
mm-hmm.
for her genealogy classes. HTTP. GenClass, GenClass.com.
Absolutely.
Yep. I'm Susan King. You can find me at www.susaneking.com or here every Tuesday on bbsradio.com. We went a little over, but we started a little late. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next week with Jean Wilcox-Hibben. We're going to talk about music and ancestry, and it's going to be an interesting show. In any event, thanks for being here, and we'll see you next week.